Former Sheriff Scott Israel is not getting his job back. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida senators voted to not reinstate Scott Israel into his old job as Broward County Sheriff. But Israel's fight may not be over. We'll get the latest from our Broward reporter, Katie Switalski. Also, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. We'll talk to one woman who defeated breast cancer, only for that cancer to come back elsewhere in her body. We'll also hear from a doctor who wants to understand why rates of breast cancer are worse for women of color, especially among Bahamian women. Finally, do you know about the Ellie Awards? It's a unique set of awards for local artists and teachers to pursue projects. We'll talk to two of the winners. One artist will create a life-size drawing of a historic site from the dinosaur era. The other will use art to show how a person in a wheelchair experiences Miami's public transit system. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Former Broward Sheriff Scott Israel will not be reinstated as the sheriff. On Wednesday, the Florida Senate voted to permanently remove Israel and support Governor Ron DeSantis' original suspension. But Israel is not gone for good. The former sheriff has filed paperwork and is expected to run for the position in next year's election. WLRN Broward reporter Katie Switalski has been following the story. She joins us now via Skype. Katie, how are you doing?
Hi, Louis. Doing well.
All right. So the Senate voted 25-15 to remove Israel for good. It was mostly Republicans voting to remove him. A few Democrats did as well. But what were the primary arguments for the removal?
There were two sides, but Republicans' main argument for not giving Israel his job back were a couple of things. There's a really old law, like from the 1800s, that talks about when a sheriff delegates his power to his deputies beneath him, they're acting on his behalf, or they're his alter egos or shadows. And so Republicans were really focused on the deputies underneath Israel that did not act and were criticized for not going into the building on the day of the shooting, and what that said about Israel's leadership. And so it really turned into a big question of how responsible is the leader of an agency for what the people underneath him do? You know, how responsible is he for creating that culture or the, you know, that work ethic? And so Republicans also looked at the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport shooting in 2017, and they looked at Broward County's radio communication system that's been a huge debate trying to get updated, and what failures it experienced during these two mass shootings in Broward County. How responsible, if at all, was Israel for trying to get that fixed?
And again, you're talking about the two shootings. There was the airport shooting, also the one at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. At least one Republican voted to return Israel to office, but he was in Tallahassee, but he wasn't, my understanding, he wasn't there for the final vote. Parkland parents, obviously considering this a great day. Who did we hear from within the Parkland community about the decision yesterday?
A lot of Parkland parents and family members of victims traveled to Tallahassee to talk with senators and plead with them ahead of this big vote. And some family members consider it an accountability victory of sorts. I don't think anybody was actively celebrating, because I think what we heard from them during the hearings was it gets them some accountability that they've been fighting for since shortly after the shooting occurred, but it's still not going to bring back their loved ones. So it's not something that they're celebrating per se, but they feel like there's been some accountability served and something was done right yesterday. And so I think one of the things we kept hearing over and over from Parkland parents and other victims' family members was that there's just been too many failures systematically with law enforcement response to let this go. And that's really how have felt since the shooting occurred in February 2018.
So briefly, let's go back over this timeline. We go back to January. Governor DeSantis takes action, removing Scott, suspending him, Scott Israel. And he was pretty harsh. The governor was pretty harsh in what he said about Scott Israel when he removed him. But again, his argument for getting the sheriff out.
His main argument was because of what happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14th, 2018. And the two specific reasons that he cited in his executive order for removing him were neglect of duty and incompetence. And part of the argument for people that said Israel should get his job back, they argued that the governor did not fulfill his burden of proof and really proving that it was neglect of duty and incompetence on Israel's part that day. And so it was really interesting to see some debate on the floor about Governor Ron DeSantis had talked about suspending Israel while he was campaigning. And so a couple of senators were a little concerned that the governor had made a campaign promise and you know, for lack of a better word, phoned it in after he was sworn in as Florida's governor. But that did not affect the vote.
Israel obviously challenged this, went to court, judge responded, and basically sided with the governor.
Yes. His case was dismissed. A Broward Circuit judge in April ruled that the grounds for his removal was legal.
Remind us of Special Master Dudley Goodlett. He came out with a report after the judge's response, much later, actually, basically recommending that the Senate should reinstate Israel. Remind us again who Goodlett is and why he made this decision.
So it's not uncommon for the Senate to seek what they call a special master, but that's really just a fancy way of saying someone who has prior legislative experience, who can hold hearings and put together an advisory report to sort of guide the Senate in their big decision to remove or not to remove. And so Dudley Goodlett is a former House of Representatives in Florida, and he had been holding hearings and putting together his own report of sorts to try and see if the governor did enough to prove Israel's individual responsibility. And what the conclusion that he came to was the governor really didn't fulfill his burden of proof, and the governor didn't go far enough to show that it was just Israel's fault. I mean, one of the things that Goodlett told senators, I mean, they listened to more than 10 hours of testimony from the governor's attorney, from Goodlett, and from Israel's attorney on Monday. And one of the things Goodlett said is, there were so many individual failures, we can't pin this all on Scott Israel.
And then, of course, as we said, the Senate did not side with Goodlett. They decided to vote Israel out. Israel later said that the vote was a sham. What have his lawyers said about what's next? Will they try to take this to federal court?
That's one option. But the statement that Scott Israel's attorney, Ben Cuny, released last night was almost sent out, I mean, pretty much immediately as the vote was happening. And it said that he's really disappointed, but he's not surprised that this went this way. He has filed his candidacy paperwork to run for election again in Broward in 2020. So has our new interim sheriff, Gregory Tony. He's also filed to run as a Democrat in 2020. So there's a whole myriad of ways that this could go. But Scott Israel made it very clear in his statement last night that he really feels like the will of the voters from the 2016 election was not respected with this.
I'm talking with Broward County reporter for WLRN, Katie Switalski. We're discussing the vote yesterday by the Senate to not reinstate Broward County former Sheriff Scott Israel. He was suspended by the governor in January for his department's response to the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. So, Katie, the former sheriff, as we've mentioned, he has filed paperwork to rerun for the office in 2020. Parkland parents are against him. But how do people in Broward in general feel about Scott Israel?
Well, groups from both sides actually traveled to Tallahassee to talk to senators on Monday during public comment. And the people that really are standing behind Scott Israel are people that stated, hey, I voted for this guy in 2016. Don't take my vote away. So it really becomes a question about democratic process. And has he done enough in these two mass emergency incidents that were fatal? Is that enough grounds to remove him from the office that voters put him in? And so I think that was the main argument you heard from Israel supporters. Now, I will mention, during the debate with senators yesterday leading up to the vote, there was a really sort of uncomfortable to watch tension between some of the senators and the Parkland parents. And particularly, I want to mention all of the Broward senators, all of the senators representing Broward, voted to have him reinstated. And so it was this uncomfortable mix of the victims' families are watching the debate yesterday, and the Broward senators are saying, you know, we sympathize with you. We don't know how you go on if it were my kid, but I still want to vote to uphold this democratic process. I can't take people's votes away.
One of the things that also had been mentioned a couple of times is there was a fear of setting a precedent and that sheriffs across the state might start fearing for their jobs if you know, there's a challenge by a politician. But have we heard from any senators or leaders about that idea that this set a tone, a precedent for the future?
Yeah, that was the primary argument that Democrats made yesterday leading up to the vote, that they were worried that if the Senate removes Israel largely based on one event, that other sheriffs are really going to fear for if there is ever a mass shooting and it goes wrong in their city or their county. And so it was really interesting to see lawmakers fall back on that argument quite a bit and really lean towards, what does this mean for the future? Can we do this? Should we be setting this precedent? And then a lot of the talk was about how much power a sheriff really has. When you elect a sheriff, that's a person that can take your liberty away and arrest you. That's not the same as other elected positions. And so I think that power really it is affecting how other sheriffs are seeing this decision.
So we're waiting to see what the next step is for the Israel camp. But obviously, as we had mentioned, he filed paperwork to run for re-election in 2020 for that same job. Has there been word about when they might start campaigning, or have they?
No, that's not something I've seen. But what's really interesting is how, Scott Israel has, through this appeals process to the Senate and through his urgency in trying to get his job back, that's almost sort of been the start of his campaign, especially with passionate letters through his attorney, statements he's made about this process and how he feels like it was a political process, not a just one, and how he's still very, very convinced that he is going to get to finish the job that Broward County voters elected him to do in 2016. That he's been set on from the beginning. So I really feel like we've already started to see that.
Have we heard anything from current Sheriff Gregory Tony?
He has not commented specifically on Scott Israel's competency. He's pretty much said that from January 11th, when he was appointed to be Broward County's interim sheriff. He won't comment on Israel directly. He's made that pretty clear. He doesn't want to play the politics. But we know that he's mentioned there's been a lot of things within BSO that he has, quote unquote, had to fix. And he's changed a lot in BSO. And he's really trying to mix up the organization. But he himself has also, like I mentioned earlier, filed paperwork to run in 2020 as a Democrat.
And you know what? So speaking of precedent, have we heard from any sheriffs across the state about this issue? Has anybody spoken up about it?
I have not seen sheriffs publicly speak up about it. I know several senators yesterday mentioned they have friends that are sheriffs, or they've spoken to sheriffs that are concerned about this. And it should be said that the chair of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Statewide Public Safety Commission is Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri. And so one of the interesting things that came into play yesterday was that the commission did not recommend, when it came out with its first report, to remove Scott Israel. The report was cited a lot by the commission yesterday, and senators really leaned on that report to say, hey, look, these are the systematic failures that the commission found in BSO's response that day. And they leaned on that, but the commission itself did not recommend to have Israel removed.
We've been talking with Broward reporter Katie Switalski about the vote yesterday by Florida senators not to reinstate Scott Israel as the sheriff of Broward County. You could read her story at WLRN.org. Katie, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, still to come, we're going to hear from a breast cancer survivor and local doctor on why women should be getting screened a lot earlier than 40. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The American Cancer Society recommends women between the ages of 40 to 44 start screening for breast cancer. New research shows that's not early enough. Women, especially women of color, are being diagnosed with breast cancer at an earlier age, many in their 30s. Joining me today in studio is Dr. Judith Hurley. She's an oncologist at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Dr. Hurley, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Also joining me is Bethany Reeb Sutherland. She was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer at the age of 37 years old. She's here to share a story with us. Bethany, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Sutherland also is the co-vice president of the local board of the Susan G. Komen Foundation here in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. Bethany, I want to start with you. Mm-hmm. This is that month when we bring more attention to this issue. But for you, it means something very different. When we come to October, how does that make you feel?
That's a good question. So I like October because I like the idea of bringing awareness to breast cancer, but I also get a little upset because I feel like people don't really know enough about breast cancer. We talk about awareness and everyone says, well, we're aware of breast cancer, but in my journey with breast cancer, I learned so much that I didn't know about breast cancer.
Do you think people just say that like, yeah, we're aware, we wear the ribbons, you know, we're with you?
I think so. I think there's a lot of people out there who might sometimes even take advantage of breast cancer by selling things that have, you know, pink ribbons on it, but don't really go to any foundations.
But so. there is a plus to it, though, right? To bring an entire month, to bring attention to it, there's still a positive to that, right?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. Dr. Hurley, I want your take on that. I mean, you know, is... It shouldn't be just once, 1 month out of the year. This is an issue. Our health is all the time. We should be focused on it all the time. Do you think, though, we're doing enough to educate people? They say they're aware, but are they?
Well, breast cancer is extremely common. Everybody knows somebody with breast cancer. You're related to somebody with breast cancer. Your best friend, your sister, your wife, your mother, your spouse. Everybody is affected by breast cancer. So having a month set aside where we... almost celebrate it. It, I think, is a good idea.
Just bringing that awareness, though. You think people are aware? You think they know somebody, but you think they're really aware?
Well, you can't be aware all the time.
Yeah.
You know, there's too much going on. So 100% of the time, you can't be aware of breast cancer. But it's good that 1/12 of the year,
yeah,
you know, we acknowledge that it's a big issue, and we try to bring attention to it so that we can spend more time actually fighting it and learning what's causing it and trying to move forward on improving the treatments and curing people.
So, Bethany, you were diagnosed 37, right?
That's correct.
Tell me about how you found out.
Oh, gosh. So I had just had a baby 2 weeks prior. He was my second. And I started noticing changes in the breast that actually ended up being affected, where I wasn't able first off to breastfeed. And then over the course of those 2 weeks, I noticed that there was a lot of dimpling, and my nipple started inverting. Signs that I wasn't even sure were related to breast cancer, to be honest. I didn't have an actual lump like most people talk about. So I went to my OB to see what was going on.
And
I was
what did you hear?
I heard first that this is unlikely that it's breast cancer because I'm too young and I don't have a family history. But fortunately, he did say, I'll give you a prescription for a mammogram, which, you know, I have young friends who don't even get that from their doctors.
You had a gut feeling, though.
I had a gut feeling.
This is an interesting part because you wrote an op-ed for FIU News about your experience. This is the part that stood out for me, is that, you know, your doctor tells you it's likely not. You're young. You're too young. But you had a gut feeling.
I had a gut feeling that something for sure was wrong. I was hoping it wasn't breast cancer, but I did know that I had to go and get those tests done.
So you find out, I mean, you know, look, I have known people, women, but also I've known men who've been diagnosed with cancer. And that's just, there's no words to describe what that moment is. You went through chemo.
Yes.
And what happened?
I lost my hair.
Eventually what happened though to the breast cancer?
The breast cancer. So I went through actually chemo, double mastectomy, radiation. I was on anti-hormonals. I was put into a chemical menopause because my breast cancer actually responds to estrogen, which is likely why it grew a lot right after having my pregnancy. So I did that all for pretty much a year. And then, you know, kind of, I don't want to say like I went on my way. I still had some treatment, you know, that my anti-hormonals that I was on, but I was kind of putting it in my past. And then
you felt you got past it. You felt that it was done.
I felt like I got past it. And then this past April, almost 3 years to the day of my initial diagnosis, I found out that it had spread to my liver, making me officially stage four metastatic breast cancer. I guess a thriver is what we sometimes like to be called.
I mean, at that point, you find that out. You know, this goes back to awareness, really, truly understanding what cancer is, breast cancer specifically, though. Did you know enough? This obviously forced you to really learn what it is and why it happened, or did it?
Well, I mean, I'm actually a researcher, so I think I have more knowledge than maybe a lot of other women. I really did go through a lot of the research trying to figure out, you know, why does this happen to young women? What is going on? Is this the best treatment that I'm supposed to be getting from my doctor? I knew the statistics a little bit. So, you know, 1/3 of women who are diagnosed, 1 in 3 of women who are early stage diagnosis, they end up finding out sometimes even many years later that their breast cancer has metastasized to somewhere else in their body.
Dr. Hurley, I mean, the first part, again, as I mentioned to Bethany, I thought was surprising in reading her story, is that the doctor would say to her, "You're young. You're young. There's nothing really to worry about." I mean, so it seems like everything we've been taught has been wrong?
It's all statistics. The fact of the matter is a 37-year-old shouldn't be developing breast cancer. And in the big picture of things, statistically speaking, he was right. You shouldn't be having breast cancer. But he didn't say, "But I'm not going to believe you." He did believe you and sent you on to get a diagnosis. It's the physicians who say, "Oh, well, it's unlikely, and therefore we're not going to go forward," where there's a problem. And so it's good to have people realize that it's not just a lump in a 63-year-old lady's breast that's breast cancer, that breast cancer can take many forms and many presentations, and that the best way, especially for young women who are particularly young and even too young for screening if there's no family history, knowing their own breasts is really important. And when they notice something different, bringing it to attention and working it out.
Where's the science right now in our understanding of, you know, how breast cancer, what are the root causes and also the treatments? Where are we in the science right now? I know it's a big question, I know.
Well, not to oversimplify, but breast cancer is complicated.
Right.
You know, there are thousands of the best and brightest have been working for the past 50 years, and still 40,000 women die every year in the United States from breast cancer, and hundreds of thousands every year.
And I don't say that to, obviously, I say that in this sense, is that because I think that the general public, and I think of myself in this situation, is, you know, this time of month, this time of year comes, and we're supposed to be aware of the issues, and yet, if you're not reading a lot, if you're not really studying a lot, you know, you think that, well, the statistics always tell me women after over 40 should be checked, and these are what the stats tell me, and, you know, a lot of women seem to get past it. She got past it at one point. So I don't really know. And so I'm just wondering, if are we doing enough to educate people? I want to know where the science is now, and I want to know if we're not doing something more to educate people on what that science is.
Well,
it is complicated. I understand. Yes.
Yeah. And I think people, to a certain extent, think, well, if I go for my screening mammograms, that's all I have to do. But it's really much more breast awareness, not breast cancer awareness, but breast awareness, and realizing what's normal for you and being able to recognize when it isn't normal and then reaching out for help when you notice that it's not normal.
Can you tell me one or two misconceptions people have about breast cancer?
Well, that breast cancer is always a lump.
Right, as we just heard, from Bethany. Yeah.
Right, and that it only happens in, you know, old ladies.
Well, okay. No. That's an interesting point. And I think this is coming back to this idea because, again, Bethany, you were 37.
You're right.
When this happened. you took your experience and you wanted to use it to educate people.
Yeah.
When did you realize that that's what you wanted to do? I mean, how long afterwards did you realize, no, I've got to use this for something?
So I guess it was percolating a little bit in my mind pretty much after my mastectomy and when I was going through radiation, because I wanted to understand why at that time, why there isn't more that's done with young women. There isn't as much research that's done with young women. You know, I know percentage-wise, we are a small percentage, but we're still talking about 10 to 12,000 women a year that are between the ages of 18 and 40 who don't necessarily get screened, right? We don't have like a mammogram type screening tool that would help us identify, you know,
right,
earlier. So, you know, most of the younger women are getting, you know, they have a lump or they find something wrong with their breast and they're usually later stage. We're not talking about stage zero, stage one, because they were already showing symptoms. So whenever I started thinking about that and kind of thinking of on some level how the system didn't work for me, the current system, I wanted to give back. I wanted to get through all my treatment, and then I, you know, hooked up with the local Susan G. Komen Miami Fort Lauderdale affiliate, and I really enjoy that. I get to go and give talks sometimes. I get to see the women that Komen has actually been helping to get the treatments that they need. I get to, you know, think about what kind of research and like actually review applications and, you know, be able to give some input on that. So, and, you know, Komen's moving to give a little bit more education on the metastatic breast cancer side, which, you know, now that I have metastatic breast cancer, I almost want to educate even more on that kind of front, because I think one of the misconceptions which has plagued me, and even whenever I was first diagnosed and getting my full body scan, you know, and the doctor said that they wanted to make sure that it hadn't spread anywhere because it had reached my lymph nodes. And then I, in my mind, thought, well, if it's spread to somewhere else, then they'll just cut it out, right? And so I didn't realize that metastatic breast cancer basically is forever. I didn't realize necessarily that it was terminal, and I didn't. And I think a lot of people don't realize that people still die of breast cancer.
Right.
Like, and if they did, it's because they... Sometimes there's a misconception that just didn't take care of themselves. They didn't get their mammograms. They didn't, you know, eat right. They didn't, you know, exercise. So,
and I think that's what I was trying to get to, is this idea that, you know, it's just easy in our culture and society to say we're aware of things and then, but then have these misconceptions and believe that they are true. Again, it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I'm talking with Dr. Judith Hurley, an oncologist at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Also talking with Bethany Reeve Sutherland. She's the board. She's the co-vice president of the local board of the Susan G. Komen Foundation here in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. Dr. Hurley, you've got this fascinating research going on right now, because when we were looking through and preparing for this, we see different groups of women of different races, ethnicities, face different challenges. One of the things that you found is, you know, that women of color do face a much different challenge. But you took it beyond that. Your research is even looking at women in the Caribbean, Bahamian women especially. How did you narrow it down to that? How did you find this? And what did you find, by the way, too?
So so the average woman with breast cancer in the United States is a 63-year-old white lady. And up until 2 or 3 years ago, the person who had the highest incidence of breast cancer were Caucasian women in the United States. And women of color, specifically women of African descent, had a lower incidence. But actually, women of African descent have caught up with the Caucasian women as of 2 or 3 years ago. But what has always happened is that women of African descent have had a higher mortality rate. So despite the fact that they have a lower incidence, they die more often of it. And initially it was easy to say, oh, well, it's just lack of care. They don't have insurance. You know, there's a lot of discrimination and they're not getting the right care. But it's actually worse than that, because that at least you could solve if you could address the inequity of care. But what we've found is that women of African descent have different kinds of breast cancer, worse kinds of breast cancer. They have what's called triple negative breast cancer in higher numbers. And it's possible that their estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, which is what we call the good actor, doesn't respond as well to hormonal therapy. So with that background, I work at Jackson and I see a lot of Bahamian women, and I noticed that they were all young. And
young being how?
Well, that they were in their 30s and 40s. And, you know, when your average breast cancer patient is supposed to be a woman who's very postmenopausal and all of your breast cancer patients are young, premenopausal, then it makes you wonder what's going on. And so I pursued that and started looking at it started in the Bahamas, looking at the reasons for breast cancer in the Bahamas. And then once I developed data on it and would speak with other oncologists in the rest of the Caribbean, they'd be like, well, that sounds like the women in my island, too. So we extended with Komen funding to 7 islands in the Caribbean, starting with the Bahamas and going to Haiti, Trinidad and Tobago, Cayman Islands, Barbados, Jamaica.
One of the things,
and Dominica.
One of the things in your research that I saw also wasn't just that in younger women, still speaking about the Bahamian aspect of the research, is that in some cases the tumors were even bigger, right?
So the average stage, most women had a stage 3 or stage 4 breast cancer, while in the United States most women have a stage 0 or 1. So there was definitely a shift to the less curable or the incurable presentation. And we discovered that each Caribbean island is unique. We didn't discover that, but their breast cancer in each Caribbean island is unique also. And in the Bahamas, the reason for the very young age of breast cancer is that they have a very high incidence of inherited mutations that cause their breast cancer. So before our research in the Bahamas, the group with the highest incidence of inherited breast cancer was women of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, who had approximately a 12 to 13% rate of inherited breast cancer. But in the Bahamas, it's 25%. So they were twice as likely to have an inherited breast cancer as the previously highest incidence subgroup.
Two things I want to hit on here. Let's start with this one, though, because we keep talking about different stages. Just briefly, let's remind people of what those stages are, what that means. If you are diagnosed, as Bethany was at the beginning, I think stage 3, mm-hmm. at the very, very beginning. But what are the stages and what do they mean?
So there are 5 different stages. Stage 0, which means you just have the non-invasive kind of breast cancer. And then stage 1 is a small tumor, 2 centimeters or under, with no lymph node involved. A stage 2, either the tumor is over 2 centimeters or the lymph nodes are involved. And then stage 3, which is a much poorer prognosis group, the tumors are either over 5 centimeters, they involve the skin, they have more than 4 lymph nodes in the axilla involved, poor prognostic findings. And then stage 4 is when it's metastatic. It's outside of the local regional area, so it can no longer be cured with surgery.
So metastatic, as we heard Bethany, as she found out years later, some years later, is that's what she had. So now it's spread and it can go anywhere.
Yes,
right?
It can.
And I mean, when that happens, then what are the options? What can you do?
Well, we have lots and lots of options. We're gifted with having lots of options. We have hormonal therapy. We have chemotherapy. We have all sorts of supportive things like the bisphosphonates and radiation therapy and surgery. There's many, 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 many approaches which we use in combination to both improve the symptoms and to extend life.
Because you tell somebody they have that you give them that diagnosis, how often in your experience do you hear people say, oh my God, that's the end? Or do they feel like, oh, there's still an option? I thought Bethany's answer was kind of interesting, but what do you tend to hear?
Well, I think that Bethany gave a first-person account that was extremely accurate and very familiar
that
to me.
You thought they can just cut it out.
Well, that's how I initially thought about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know, whenever I was first diagnosed, I didn't know anything about breast cancer. I just knew it happened. And I knew it happened to older women. I knew that you're supposed to start your mammograms at 40. Like I didn't have a family history or anything. So, you know, you think about any other cancer, right? you know, liver cancer or other like lung cancer, you would cut out, you know, or depending, I'm assuming how big the area is, but that's exactly what I had thought. And what I've come to find out, you know, even before I was diagnosed, is that because it's not necessarily curable, like the doctors, unless it's, you know, maybe localized, don't really cut out the masses,
yeah.
You know, but I still have people who ask me about my treatment. They're like, well, why don't they just cut it out?
Right. For you real quickly, I want to end on this note is you go around, Bethany, you talk to women, especially younger women. Is it difficult to convince them, hey, it's don't wait till you're 40. Get checked. Understand what your understand your breast, understand breast health, understand these things. Is it hard to get them to, you know?
I don't think so. So my message is mostly, you know, if you think something might be wrong, you have to be an advocate for yourself, right? So if it's, you know your body the best, more than your doctors do. And so if you go to a doctor and you say, I know that something's wrong, you know, I think I need a mammogram, and they actually, you know, give you an examination, they say, no, especially if they say, I think you're too young, I would go find another doctor.
Dr. Hurley, real quickly, I almost get the sense, do we have to retrain our culture? Like, no, it's not just 40. Understand your health, maybe even get checked way earlier than that. Do we have to rethink that?
Well, I think we just need to realize that there's a spectrum of disease, and that although most of the disease is in the 50, 60, 70-year-old age group, because it's going to continue on to the upper ages and also down to the lower ages. There are just a lot of women, and so statistically speaking, you're going to have women who are in their 20s. They're not going to be many of them, but they exist, and their disease is just as lethal as anybody else's. And I agree with you, have to be an advocate for yourself. And nobody knows your breasts like you do.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Judith Hurley is an oncologist at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. We'll share some of that research that she's been working on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Also, Bethany Reeve Sutherland, she is, again, the co-vice president of the local board of the Susan G. Komen Foundation here in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. Bethany, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And Dr. Hurley, thank you so much for the information. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Definitely. Well, still to come, we're going to meet two local artists who were just awarded some cash to launch big projects here in Miami. Well, that's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Last night, Oolite Arts, a nonprofit arts organization in South Florida, announced their second annual winners of the Ellies Awards. Now, these awards celebrate artists and art teachers in South Florida, with $500,000 to be used for projects here and around the globe. Joining me in studio today are two of the Visual Art Awards winners. David McCauley is an interdisciplinary artist whose work focuses on inclusion and accessibility. David, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also, congratulations.
Thank you.
And Christina Peterson's work focuses on engaging the community with our regional landscape. Christina, thanks for being here. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And you know what? I just got to say, by the way, looking at both of your art, I wish it was visual, because people have got to check it out. They really have to see it. We'll share some of that on our website too, by the way, so that they can. David, I want to start with you and get some of your background. You weren't focused on art your whole life, you know, as a child, even though your mother was a landscape artist, right?
Yes, true.
When did you get into it?
So I used to do a lot of photography back in the day, but it wasn't so much artistic photography. It was more capturing my friends and I, like snowboarding and skateboarding and stuff like that. And then I had an injury about 11 years ago, and through that recovery process, I was introduced to art therapy. And it really had a profound effect upon me, so much so I shifted my entire career from finance and technology to nonprofit direction and my own art practice.
How did you find, for any artist, you try to find that the right medium, you try to find, you know, the discipline that allows you to best express yourself? How did you find that for you?
You know, I think it's a continuing like discovery process because I have limited dexterity in my hands. I was always trying to figure out adaptive ways and techniques and different mark making techniques that I could use readily and be independent without any type of studio assistance. And that's still ongoing today.
Yeah. Like some of the stuff, for example, I mean, just, you know, to share with folks, I mean, you're in a wheelchair, but as you said, you have limited dexterity. What are some of the tools that you use?
I typically use a 4 to 5 foot long piece of bamboo, and I kind of like cram it into my glove so I can have a 90 degree perspective from the painting that I'm working on at the moment. So it's a la Sorolla style from that era.
And it's, I mean, it's amazing when you think about some of the work, some of the pieces that you put together. I want to talk about the piece that you're going to be working on, you know, with this award. Christina, you were born in Sweden, but you've been living in South Florida, what, since you were 6, right?
Yes, exactly.
What got you into art? When did it start for you?
Longer than I can remember. My mom had me in lessons by the time I was 6, so it was pretty much all I was ever going to do.
And for you, I mean, was the natural environment always the inspiration? Because, I mean, so much of your artwork focuses on the beauty, the natural beauty in our world. Has that always been the case?
Not always the case in my artwork. I think in my real life, I was always a bit of a wild child, but it really was when I came back here about 15 years ago. And then I did a couple of local residencies at the Deering Estate and then and the Everglades National Park. And that was the one that really kicked it up to a full-time obsession.
Right. That was a fellowship that you had, right, in the Everglades?
That was an ARI residency, artist in Everglades. Everglades.
All right. This was so cool. So reading about it, so you were doing these drawings, hyper-realistic detail, by the way. What is the process for capturing, you know, that kind of detail? Is it just natural for you?
No, it's not. It's kind of weird. I think in my regular life, I'm not that obsessive compulsive or detail oriented. It's a bit of a mystery to me as well. But I think it's the need to capture everything that I'm seeing that has led to the desire to do so.
Now, one of the things I thought was really cool about that that process for you and that program at the Everglades, you like to work at night.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of in the dark, sort of.
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a witch.
Please, well, help me understand, how do you do that?
I'm not working in the dark drawing, but a lot of what I did when I was on my residencies was out exploring at night. I find it so amazing that the park is open 24 hours. That's not something people know necessarily. And, you know, nature doesn't shut off because the lights go off and it doesn't become evil all of a sudden. And I'm so interested in that disconnect that has happened with humans. And I think a lot of it is being afraid of the dark and being afraid of being out at night. So overcoming that myself was really important. And then realizing how beautiful it was to be out there with the owls and the shooting stars. And I really wanted to bring that into my work.
And you just said a little while ago that experience at the Everglades was a big point for you in your career.
Absolutely. Fundamentally, took it to front and center of my work and my passion and what I'm trying to beat into the heads of people who live here in a really pretty way.
I'm talking with Christina Peterson and David McCauley, the two South Florida-based artists, among the winners of the Ellies and Oolite Art Grants Awards. And you can see some of David and Christina's pieces. Go to WLRN.org. Truly fascinating. David, one of the things, you'll use a lot of text and graphic design to tell stories. Tell us about this proposal that you have to create an interactive piece about, I love this, Miami-Dade's bus system. We have these conversations about the bus system in this show so many times. What are you going to do? Tell me.
So I have a background in cultural anthropology, and I'm also a public transportation advocate. So whenever you're riding the rails or buses, you kind of observe people day in, day out, commuting to work, maybe going to the market, and I find it fascinating. And Miami is such a diverse place. One of the things I've noticed, and I always use the 7 bus as an example, it originates downtown and goes up 7th Avenue for 100 plus blocks, and you slowly migrate from downtown into Overtown, into Wynwood, Alapata, Little Haiti, Liberty City, and you can imagine the different types of cultures, people, fashion, dialects being spoken, change every 10, 15 blocks. And that's something that I've just been pondering in my head for such a long time. And now with the help from the Ellies and Oolite, I'll be able to communicate that story visually.
Have you already started working on the project and how, or at least the idea of what you want it to be?
Well, the idea is still in its infancy, and I think it'll certainly evolve over the next 8 to 12 months. But I certainly want to capture a lot of video work and do some interviews and have people actually be able to tell their story.
You know, for you, because, you know, and I find that interesting, is that you're a regular public transit user. I wonder how that, what that experience is like for you, because, you know, I think a lot of us take it for granted. But, you know, because your mobility, it's a little bit different for you. And I wonder, what's your take on that mobility in the city? Does the city provide those opportunities?
Well, you know, we just had a brief conversation about that before we came into the studio, about in other major American cities that have efficient and effective public transportation, it's kind of like a great equalizer. In New York City, you'll see professional athletes, celebrities, politicians on the subway. Miami, I think it's a bit more segregated socioeconomically. Miamians love their cars. They like their flashy cars and like to rev their engines loud and stuff like that. But it's Miami, it's an interesting demographic that uses public transportation.
Do you, I mean, because you said it's in its infancy, do you have an idea, though, of, there's no timeline for you. I mean, you could work on it as long as you want, but do you have an idea of how, when you are going to start it?
I'll be starting it soon. A couple of my colleagues are going to be helping me start capturing film footage probably in November. Even thought about having like body cams to get my point of view perspective, which is, you know, closer to somebody's hip height, hip level, or what it's like to, you know, get on board a bus and a wheelchair and such. So I think so many ideas right now that we'll spin into the project.
Christina, your proposal falls in line with your passion. Tell us a little bit about, you're going to be doing a drawing of this ancient historic site at the Deering Estate. Tell us what you're working on.
Yeah, I want to do a drawing somewhat to scale of the Cutler Fossil Site, which is a large sinkhole on the Miami Rock Ridge within the Deering Estate property. And it's this incredibly important archaeological site in which they have found numerous megalofauna and human remains from the Paleo-Indian era. And it really establishes Miami and Florida at large as this ancient place. And it's something that is not very much in the consciousness of most Floridians. You know, we tend to think that it was a blank slate and then Flagler came along with his train and his civilization and put some buildings on top. And this really blows all that out of the water.
What are the, because of the size, the scope of the project, what are the challenges that you're facing already?
Well, I mean, if I wanted to try to give people as much of an indication of the experience of being there, which unfortunately they can't because it has to be protected, I'm going to have to figure out a way in which to make the piece mobile. I mean, I, you know, traditionally work on paper, so I'm looking at doing something that's more in a round wooden panel. You know, I've recently visited the Cyclorama. I don't know if you're familiar with that. In Atlanta, it's this giant 360-degree painting. It's amazing. So much smaller scale.
Wow.
To do something like that with curved wooden panels, that would be to size, which is about 30 feet by 12, 13 feet high.
Yeah. Where are you right now? I mean, at the beginning of the process?
Or very beginning of the process. Okay. This was just an idea thrown out, and thanks to the Ellies, I get to make it happen.
How long do you think it's going to take you?
Some months, for sure. But I'm really excited because I'm also going to be able to connect. You know, I'm friends with Jennifer Tisthammer, who's the director of Deering, is a powerhouse, and she's already offered to take me to the Florida Museum of Natural History in Gainesville, where a lot of the fossils were taken. And so we're really going to be able to form a partnership that'll go hopefully far beyond the drawing.
When you guys are done, I want you back. We got to see these. This looks really, sounds really interesting. Again, David McCauley, Christina Peterson, the two South Florida-based artists, winners of the Ellies and the Oolite Grant Awards. Congratulations to both of you. Again, looking forward to seeing the work.
Thank Thank you so much, Louis.
Thanks, Louis.
All right. And that's our program for this Thursday, October 24th. Coming up next week on Sundial, after 50 years with Miami-Dade College, former president Eduardo Padron has stepped down. Now the massive community college system is in search for a new president. We spoke with the interim president, Rolando Montoya, about the search and his goals while in office. Plus, esports has exploded in popularity across South Florida. So much so, there's now a plan to build an esports racing arena in Wynwood. We're going to talk with a gamer about how to make a living in esports and understand why it's become so big down here. And finally, our conversation with FIU professor and historian Les Standiford. His new book, Palm Beach, Mar-a-Lago, and the Rise of America's Xanadu. It tells the story behind Palm Beach County's elite. There's stories of secret business dealings, political intrigue. It's got a little bit of everything. You'll enjoy it, I promise. That's our program. Remember to find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think of the program, always. And don't forget about it. We have a podcast. So if you missed the show, you can always find us on a podcast forum. Find us on iTunes, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.